Then please call him. Call Major Alexander Fisher, MP, bellowed the clerk. The double doors at the back of the courtroom swung open, and in marched Fisher, with a swagger that took even Giles by surprise. Clearly becoming a Member of Parliament had only added to his considerable self-esteem. He took the Bible in his right hand and delivered the oath, without once looking at the card the clerk held up for him. When Mr. Trelford rose from his place, Fisher stared at him as if he had the enemy in his sights.
"Good morning, Major Fisher,"
said Trelford, but received no response.
"Would you be kind enough to state your name and occupation for the court records?"
"My name is Major Alexander Fisher, and I am the Member of Parliament for Bristol Docklands," he said, looking directly at Giles.
At the time of Barrington Shipping's annual general meeting that is the subject of this libel, were you a director of the company?
I was.
And was it Mrs. Clifton who invited you to sit on the board?
No, it was not.
So who was it who asked you to represent them as a director?
Lady Virginia Fenwick.
And why, may I ask? Were you friends, or was it simply a professional relationship?
I would like to think both, said Fisher, glancing down at Lady Virginia, who nodded and smiled.
And what particular expertise did you have to offer, Lady Virginia?
I was a stockbroker by profession before I became an MP.
I see, said Trelford. So you were able to offer advice to Lady Virginia on her share portfolio, and because of your wise counsel, she invited you to represent her on the board of Barrington's.
I couldn't have put it better myself, Mr. Trelford, said Fisher,
a smug smile appearing on his face.
But are you sure that was the only reason Lady Virginia selected you, Major?
Yes, I am sure,
Bart Fisher, the smile disappearing.
I'm just a little puzzled, Major, how a stockbroker based in Bristol becomes a professional advisor to a lady living in London, who must have access to any number of leading stockbrokers in the city. So perhaps I should ask how you first met.
Lady Virginia supported me when I first stood for Parliament as the Conservative candidate for Bristol Docklands.
And who was the Labour candidate at that election?
Sir Giles Barrington.
Lady Virginia's ex-husband and Mrs. Clifton's brother.
Yes.
So now we know why Lady Virginia chose you as her representative on the board.
What are you suggesting?
Snapped Fisher.
Quite simply, that if you had stood for Parliament in any other constituency, you would never have come across Lady Virginia.
Mr. Trelford looked at the jury while he waited for Fisher's reply, because he was confident none would be forthcoming.
Now that we have established your relationship with the plaintiff, let us consider the value and importance of your professional advice. You will recall, Major, that I earlier asked you if you advised Lady Virginia on her share portfolio, and you confirmed that you did.
That is correct.
Then perhaps you can tell the jury which shares, other than Barrington Shipping, you advised her ladyship on.
Again, Mr. Trelford waited patiently before he spoke again.
I suspect the answer is none, and that her only interest in you was as an insider, to let her know what was going on at Barrington's, so both of you could take advantage of any information to which you were privy as a board member.
That is an outrageous suggestion, said Fisher, looking up at the judge,
but she remained impassive.
If that is the case, Major, could you deny that on three separate occasions you advised Lady Virginia to sell her shares in Barrington's? I have the dates, the times, and the amounts in front of me, and on each occasion, just a couple of days later, the company announced some bad news.
That is what advisers are for, Mr. Trelford.
And then, some 3 weeks after that, you bought the shares back, which I would suggest was for two reasons. First, to make a quick profit, and second, to be sure that she retained her 7.5% of the company's stock, so you didn't lose your place on the board. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been privy to any more inside information, would you?
That is a disgraceful slur on my professional reputation,
barked Fisher. Is it? Said Trawford, holding up a sheet of paper for everyone to see, before reading out the figures in front of him. On the three transactions in question, Lady Virginia made profits of £17,400, £29,320, and £70,100, respectively.
It's not a crime to make a profit for one's client, Mr. Trawford.
No, it most certainly is not, Major. But why did you need to use a broker in Hong Kong to carry out these transactions, a Mr. Benny Driscoll?
Benny is an old friend who used to work in the city, and I am loyal to my friends, Mr. Trawford.
I am sure you are, Major. But were you aware that at the time of your dealings, the Irish Garda had a warrant out for Mr. Driscoll's arrest for fraud and share manipulation?
Sir Edward was quickly on his feet.
Yes, yes, Sir Edward, said Mrs. Justice Lane. I do hope, Mr. Trawford, you are not suggesting that Major Fisher was aware of this warrant, but was still willing to do business with Mr. Driscoll.
That would have been my next question, my lady, said Trawford,
the innocent schoolboy look returning.
No, I did not know, protested Fisher, and had I done so, I certainly wouldn't have continued to deal with him.
That's reassuring, said Trawford.
He opened a large black file in front of him and took out a single sheet of paper covered in figures.
When you purchased shares on behalf of Lady Virginia, how were you paid?
On commission. 1% of the buying or selling price, which is standard practice.
Very right and proper, said Trawford,
making a show of putting the sheet of paper back in his file. He then extracted a second sheet, which he studied with equal interest.
Tell me, Major, were you aware that on each occasion after you had asked your loyal friend, Mr. Driscoll, to carry out these transactions for Lady Virginia, he also bought and sold shares in Barrington's on his own behalf, which he must have known was illegal?
I had no idea he was doing that, and I would have reported him to the Stock Exchange had I been aware of it.
Would you indeed? So, you had no idea that he made several thousand pounds piggybacking your transactions?
No, I did not.
And that he has recently been suspended by the Hong Kong Exchange for unprofessional conduct?
I was not aware of that, but then I haven't dealt with him for several years.
Haven't you?
Said Trawford, returning the second sheet to his file and taking out a third. He adjusted his glasses and studied a row of figures on the page in front of him before saying,
Did you also, on three separate occasions, buy and sell shares for yourself, making a handsome profit each time?
Trawford continued to stare at the sheet of paper he held in his hand, painfully aware that all Fisher had to say was, I did not, and his bluff would have been called. However, the Major hesitated, just for a moment, which allowed Trawford to add during the brief silence,
I don't have to remind you, Major Fisher, as a Member of Parliament, that you are under oath, and of the consequences of committing perjury.
Trawford continued to study the row of figures in front of him.
But I didn't make a profit on the third transaction, Fisher blurted out. In fact, I made a loss.
A gasp went up around the court, followed by an outbreak of chattering. Trawford waited for complete silence before he continued.
So you made a profit on the first two transactions, Major, but suffered a loss on the third.
Fisher shuffled uneasily in the box, but made no attempt to reply.
Major Fisher, you stated earlier to the court that it's not a crime to make a profit for one's client, said Trawford,
looking down at a scribbled note to check the Major's exact words.
Yes, I did, said Fisher,
trying to recover.
But as a qualified stockbroker, you will have known that it was a crime, continued Trawford,
picking up a thick red leather-bound volume from the bench in front of him and opening it at a page marked with a slip of paper.
to trade shares in a company of which you sit on the board. Trelford read out the exact words. Unless you have informed the chairman of that company and sought legal guidance. He let his words sink in before slamming the book shut and asking quietly, Did you inform Mrs. Clifton or seek legal guidance? Fisher gripped the sides of the witness box to stop his hands from shaking. Can you tell the court how much profit you made when you bought and sold your Barrington shares? Asked Trelford, as he continued to look down at a hotel bill from his recent trip to Hong Kong. He waited for some time before he placed the receipt back in his file, looked up at the judge and said, My lady, as Major Fisher seems unwilling to answer any more of my questions, I see no purpose in continuing. He sat down and smiled at Emma. Sir Edward, said Mrs. Justice Lane, Do you wish to cross-examine the witness?
Just a couple of questions, if I may,
said Sir Edward, sounding unusually subdued.
Major Fisher, is there any suggestion that Lady Virginia Fenwick was aware that you were trading in Barrington shares on your own behalf?
No, sir.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you were simply her adviser. And all the transactions carried out in her name were conducted within the full rigours of the law.
There were indeed, Sir Edward. I am obliged to you for that clarification. No more questions, my lady.
The judge was writing furiously, while Fisher remained motionless in the witness box, looking like a rabbit caught in the headlights. Finally, she put her pen down and said,
Before you leave the court, Major Fisher, I must tell you that I intend to send a transcript of your evidence to the Department of Public Prosecutions, so they can decide if any further legal action should be taken.
As the Major stepped out of the witness box and made his way out of the courtroom, the press corps deserted their benches and followed him out into the corridor like a pack of baying hounds pursuing a wounded fox. Giles leaned forward, patted Trelford on the back and said,
Well done, sir. You crucified him.
Him, yes, but not her. Thanks to those two carefully worded questions from Sir Edward, Lady Virginia lives to fight another day.
Chapter 41 Something was wrong. Surely this couldn't possibly be Anatoly Babakov. Harry stared at the frail skeleton of a man who shuffled into the courtroom and collapsed onto the stool opposite the state prosecutor. Babakov was dressed in a suit and shirt that hung on him as if he were a coat hanger. They were both several sizes too large for him, and Harry's first thought was that he must have borrowed them from a stranger that morning. And then he realized that they were Babakov's own suit and shirt. He just hadn't worn them since the day he'd been sent to prison. All those years ago. His hair was thinning, and the few strands left were steel grey. His eyes, also grey, had sunk back into their sockets, and his skin was lined and parched, not from the heat of the sun, but from endless hours of exposure to the frozen winds borne on the Siberian plains. Babakov looked about 70, even 80, although Harry knew they were contemporaries, so he couldn't be much more than 50. The state prosecutor rose from his place, the sycophant replaced by the bully. He looked right through Babakov and addressed him with a cold arrogance, so different from the manner afforded to the comrade colonel when he'd been in the witness box.
Tell the court your name and number,
he demanded.
Babakov, 74162, comrade prosecutor.
Do not address me in that familiar manner.
The prisoner bowed his head.
I apologize, sir.
Before you were convicted, Babakov, what was your occupation?
I was a schoolteacher in the 7th district of Moscow.
How many years did you teach at that school?
13 years, sir.
And the subject you taught?
English.
What were your qualifications? I graduated from the Foreign Language Institute in Moscow in 1941.
So after graduating, your first job was as a schoolteacher, and you've never worked anywhere else?
No, sir. I have not.
During those 13 years as a schoolteacher, did you ever visit the Kremlin?
No, I did not, sir. Never.
The vehemence with which Babakov said never was a clear indication to Harry that he regarded this mock trial as worthy only of ridicule. Every Soviet schoolchild had visited the Kremlin at some time to pay homage at Lenin's tomb. If Babakov had been a schoolmaster, he would even have supervised such visits. Harry had no way of letting him know that he'd got the message without breaking the thin shell of deception.
At any time, did you ever meet our revered leader, the chairman of the Presidium Council, Comrade Stalin?
Continued the state prosecutor.
Yes. On one occasion, when I was a student, he visited the Foreign Languages Institute to present the annual state awards.
Did he speak to you?
Yes. He congratulated me on being awarded my degree.
Harry knew Babakov had won the Lenin Medal and come top of his class. Why didn't he mention that? Because it wasn't part of the well-prepared script he had been given, and which he was sticking to. The answers had probably been written by the same person who was asking the questions.
Other than that brief encounter, did you ever come across Comrade Stalin again?
No, sir. Never.
Once again, he exaggerated the word never. Harry was beginning to form a plan in his mind. If it was to work, he would have to convince those three stony-faced comrades sitting in judgment that he believed every word Babakov was uttering, and was appalled ever to have been taken in by the man.
I should now like to move on to 1954, when you attempted to have a book published, in which you claimed that you had worked on the president's private staff for 13 years as his personal interpreter, when in fact you had never once entered the Kremlin. What made you think you could possibly get away with such a deception?
Because, like me, no one who worked at the Sarkozy press had ever been inside the Kremlin. They had only seen Comrade Stalin from a distance when he reviewed our troops at the May Day parade. So it wasn't difficult to convince them that I had been a member of his inner circle.
Harry shook his head in disgust and frowned at Babakov, hoping he wasn't overdoing it. He saw the chairman make a note on the pad in front of her. Was there even the suggestion of a smile?
And is it also true that you planned to defect in the hope of having your book published in the West with the sole purpose of making a large sum of money?
Yes. I thought that if I could fool the people at the Sarkozy press, how much easier it would be to convince the Americans and the British that I had been a party official working alongside the chairman. After all, how many people from the West have ever visited the Soviet Union, let alone spoken to the comrade chairman, who everyone knows didn't speak a word of English?
Harry put his head in his hands, and when he looked up, he stared at Babakov with contempt. The chairman made another note on her pad.
Once you'd completed the book, why didn't you defect at the first opportunity?
I didn't have enough money. I had been promised an advance on the day of publication, but I was arrested before I could collect it.
But your wife did defect.
Yes. I sent her ahead of me with our life savings, hoping I would be able to join her later.
Harry was appalled by how the prosecutor was mixing half-truths with lies, and wondered how they could possibly think, even for a moment, that he might be deceived by this pantomime. But that was their weakness. Clearly, all of them were taken in by their own propaganda, so he decided to play them at their own game. He nodded whenever the prosecutor seemed to have scored a point, but then he recalled his drama teacher at school chastising him, on more than one occasion, for overacting, so he reined it in.
"Did your wife take a copy of the book with her?"
demanded the prosecutor.
No. It hadn't been published by the time she left. And in any case, she would have been searched when she tried to cross the border. And if she'd had the book with her, she would have been arrested and sent straight back to Moscow.
But thanks to some brilliant detective work, you were arrested, charged, and sentenced before even one copy of your book reached the shops.
Yes,
said Babakov, bowing his head again.
And when you were charged with offenses against the state, how did you plead?
Guilty to all charges.
And the People's Court sentenced you to 20 years hard labor?
Yes, sir. I was lucky to receive such a light sentence for the despicable crime I had committed against the nation.
Once again, Harry realized that Babakov was letting him know he considered the whole trial to be a sham. But it was still important for Harry to look as if he was being taken in by the play within a play.
That concludes my examination of this witness, Comrade German,
said the prosecutor, who then bowed low and sat down. The chairman glanced at the young man who was seated at the other end of the bench.
Do you have any questions for this witness?
The young man rose unsteadily to his feet.
No, I do not, Comrade Chairman. The prisoner Babakov is clearly an enemy of the state.
Harry felt sorry for the young man, who probably believed every word he'd heard in the courtroom that morning. Harry gave a slight nod to show he also agreed, although the young man's inexperience had once again given the game away. If he had read more Chekhov, he would have realized that silence can often be more powerful than the spoken word.
Take him away,
said the tribunal chairman. As Babakov was led out of the courtroom, Harry bowed his head as if he no longer wanted anything to do with the man.
Comrades, it has been a long day, said the chairman, turning to the jury. As Monday is a national holiday, on which we will all remember those brave men and women who sacrificed their lives in the siege of Leningrad, this court will not reconvene until Tuesday morning, when I will sum up the state's position, so you can decide if the prisoner is guilty.
Harry wanted to laugh. He wasn't even going to be allowed to give evidence. But he was now well aware that this was a tragedy, not a comedy, and he still had his part to play. The tribunal president rose from her chair and led her colleagues out of the courtroom. No sooner had the door closed behind them than two prison guards grabbed Harry by the arms and dragged him out of the room. As he had nearly 4 days of solitude ahead of him, he was already looking forward to the challenge of seeing how much more he could remember of Uncle Joe. Chapter 3. He began mouthing the words as they bundled him out of court. Stalin not only made history, but was also happy to rewrite it, and there is no better example than the way he treated his family. His second wife, Nadia, took her own life because she would rather die than remain married to such an evil tyrant. On hearing of her death, Stalin immediately ordered that her suicide was to remain a state secret, as he feared the truth would bring him disgrace in the eyes of his comrades and enemies alike. One of the guards unlocked the heavy cell door, and his colleague pushed the prisoner inside. Even as he fell on the floor, Harry sensed that he was not alone in the cell. He looked up and saw him hunched in the corner, a forefinger pressed firmly to his lips.
Speak only in English,
were Babakov's first words. Harry nodded and looked back to see one of the guards staring through the bars. The charade was still being played out. He crouched down a few feet away from Babakov.
They need to believe you were convinced by everything you've just witnessed,
Babakov whispered.
If they do, they'll allow you to go home.
But how will that help you?
Asked Harry.
Especially if I have to sign a confession, saying that I accept you made it all up.
Because I can tell you how to get your hands on a copy of Uncle Joe without being caught.
Is that still possible?
Yes,
said Babakov. After listening carefully to his new cellmate's whispered explanation, Harry smiled.
Why didn't I think of that?
I appreciate you finding the time to see me, said Griff, especially while you're in the middle of your sister's trial.
Urgent isn't a word you use often, said Giles. And as you caught the first train to London, I assumed it had to be serious.
It won't become public for a few days, said Griff. But my mole in the local Tory party office tells me there's going to be a meeting of their executive committee this evening, and there's only one item on the agenda, to call for the member's resignation.
And that would mean a by-election, said Giles thoughtfully,
which is why I caught the first train to London.
But Conservative Central Office would never allow Fisher to resign while the government is so far behind in the opinion polls.
They won't have a lot of choice if the press goes on calling Fisher the galloping major. And you know only too well what that lot are like once they smell blood. Frankly, I can't see Fisher lasting more than a few days. So the sooner you get back down to the constituency, the better.
I will. The moment the trial's over.
When is that likely to be?
A few more days, a week at the most.
If you could come down at the weekend, be seen shopping in Broadmead on Saturday morning, go and watch Rovers play in the afternoon, and then attend matins at St. Mary Redcliffe on Sunday, it will remind people you're still alive and kicking.
If there is a by-election, how would you rate my chances?
Of being re-selected as a candidate or of winning the seat back?
Both.
You're still just about favourite to be the candidate, although several women on the executive keep raising the fact that you've had two marriages break down. But I'm working on them. And it helps that you turned down a place in the Lords because you wanted to fight the seat again.
I told you that in the strictest confidence, said Giles.
And I told all 16 members of the executive committee in the strictest confidence, replied Griff.
Giles smiled.
And my chances of winning back the seat?
A poodle wearing a red rosette would win the by-election if all Ted Heath can come up with is to call a state of emergency every time there's a strike.
Then perhaps it's time to tell you my other news.
Griff raised an eyebrow.
I'm going to ask Karen to marry me.
Could it possibly be after the by-election?
Begged Griff.
Chapter 42. For everyone involved in the libel trial, it turned out to be a long weekend. Following a short consultation with Mr. Trelford immediately after the court had been adjourned for the day, Giles drove Emma down to Gloucestershire.
Would you prefer to stay at the Hall over the weekend? Marsden will take care of you. It's kind of you to offer, said Emma. But I ought to be at home just in case Harry calls. I think that's unlikely, said Giles quietly.
Why? Demanded Emma.
I visited Sir Alan at number 10 before the court resumed yesterday morning, and he told me Harry had booked himself onto a BOAC flight last Friday evening, but never boarded the plane.
Then they must have arrested him.
I fear so.
Why didn't you tell me immediately?
Moments before you went into the witness box? I don't think that would have been helpful.
Did Sir Alan have any other news?
He told me that if we haven't heard from Harry by Monday morning, the Foreign Secretary will call in the Russian ambassador and demand an explanation.
What good will that do?
He'll realise that Harry will be on the front page of every paper around the world the next day if they don't release him, which is the last thing the Russians will want.
Then why arrest him in the first place? Demanded Emma.
They're up to something. But even Sir Alan can't work out what it is.
Giles didn't tell Emma about his recent experience when he tried to enter East Berlin, not least because he'd assumed that Harry was unlikely to get beyond passport control and would have been frog-marched back onto the next plane to Heathrow. It made no sense that they would detain the president of English Penn without good reason. Even the Soviets don't like bad publicity if they can possibly avoid it. Like Sir Alan, he couldn't work out what they were up to. During a sleepless weekend, Emma occupied herself answering letters, reading, even polishing some of the family silver, but she was never more than a few paces away from the phone. Sebastian rang on Saturday morning, and when she heard his voice,
She thought for a moment, just a moment, that it was Harry.
"It's ours to lose,"
was the expression Sir Edward used during the consultation with Lady Virginia in his chambers on the Friday evening. He advised her to spend a quiet weekend, no late nights, and not to drink too much. She had to be rested, calm, and ready to do battle with Trelford when she stepped into the witness box on Monday morning.
"Just confirm that you always allowed Major Fisher, your professional adviser, to handle anything to do with Barrington's." "At arm's length,"
was the phrase he kept repeating.
"You've never heard of Mr. Benny Driscoll, and it came as a great shock when you discovered that Cedric Hardcastle had been dumping all his shares on the market the weekend before the AGM. You simply felt, as a stockholder, that Mrs. Clifton should tell you the truth and not fob you off with a self-serving platitude. And whatever you do, don't rise to Trelford's bait, because he'll try to tickle you under the chin like a trout. Swim in the deep water, and don't be tempted to come up to the surface, because if you do, he'll hook you and slowly reel you in. And finally, just because things have gone well for us so far, that doesn't mean you should become overconfident. I've seen far too many cases lost on the last day of the trial by a client who thought they'd already won. Remember," he repeated, "it's ours to lose."
Sebastian spent most of his weekend at the bank, trying to catch up with a backlog of unanswered correspondence and dozens of urgent queries that Rachel had left in his in-tray. It took all of Saturday morning just to tackle the first pile. Mr. Bishara's inspired choice as the new chairman of Farthings had been greeted in the city with acclamation, which made Seb's life much easier. A few customers closed their accounts when Sloane departed, but many more returned when they discovered his successor would be Ross Buchanan. An experienced, shrewd operator with bottom was how the Sunday Times described him. Sebastian called his mother just before lunch on Saturday and tried to reassure her that there was nothing for her to worry about.
"He probably can't get through. Can you imagine what the Russian telephone service must be like?"
But he wasn't convinced by his own words. His father had expressly told him he would be back in time for the trial, and he couldn't help remembering one of his papa's favourite maxims.
"There's only one excuse to be late for a lady. Death."
Seb grabbed a quick lunch with Vic Kaufman, who was worried about his own father, but for a different reason. It was the first time he'd mentioned Alzheimer's.
"I'm becoming painfully aware that Dad is a one-man band. He beats the big drum while the rest of us are occasionally allowed to bang the cymbals. Perhaps the time has come for Farthings and Kaufmans to consider a merger."
Seb couldn't pretend that the idea hadn't crossed his mind since he'd become deputy chairman. But Vic's suggestion couldn't have come at a worse time, while he had so many other things on his mind.
"Let's talk about it as soon as the trial is over. And by the way," Seb added, "be sure to keep a close eye on Sloane, because rumour in the city is that he's also showing a keen interest in your father's health."
Seb was back behind his desk just after 2 o'clock and went on attacking the pile of unopened mail for the rest of the day. He didn't get home until after midnight. A security man let him into the bank on Sunday morning, but it wasn't until late on Sunday afternoon that he came across a cream envelope marked Private and Confidential, with 6 George Washington stamps in the top right-hand corner. He ripped it open and read a letter from Rosemary Wolfe. How could he possibly take time off to go to America now? How could he possibly not? Giles did as he was told. He spent Saturday morning walking up and down Broadmead, carrying a large, empty Marks & Spencer shopping bag. He shook hands with anyone who stopped to talk to him about the dreadful Conservative government and that awful Ted Heath. If anyone raised the subject of Major Fisher, he remained diplomatic.
"I wish you were still our MP. If only I'd known, I would never have voted for him. It's a scandal. The damn man ought to resign." To which Giles responded with a well-prepared reply.
That's a decision for Major Fisher and his constituency party to make, so we'll just have to wait and see.
Later, he sat at the bar of a packed, noisy pub and had a ploughman's lunch with Griff, washed down with a pint of Somerset cider.
If Fisher resigns and a by-election is called, said Griff, I've already told the Bristol Evening News that the local Labour Party won't be interviewing anyone other than the former member.
Cheers, said Giles, raising his glass. How did you manage that?
Twisted a few arms, made the odd threat, offered the occasional bribe, and promised the chairman an MBE.
Nothing new, then.
Except that I did remind the committee that if the Tories are going to have a new name on the ballot paper, perhaps we should stick with one the voters are familiar with.
What are you doing about the increased aircraft noise what's coming out of Filton? That's a bloody disgrace.
I'm no longer your MP, Giles reminded the man politely as he headed towards the door.
I didn't know that. When did that happen?
Even Griff had the grace to laugh. After they had left the pub, they both donned their blue and white scarves, and along with 6,000 other supporters, watched Bristol Rovers beat Chesterfield 3-2. In the evening, Emma came to Barrington Hall for dinner, but she wasn't very good company. She left long before Marsden served coffee. Giles settled down in his grandfather's favourite chair in the drawing-room, a brandy in one hand, a cigar in the other. He was thinking about Karen when the phone rang. He grabbed it, hoping to hear Harry's voice on the other end of the line, but it was Griff. Who else would call him at that time of night? When Griff told him the news about Fisher, Giles felt sorry for the man for the first time in his life. Mr. Trelford spent his weekend preparing for Lady Virginia's cross-examination, but it wasn't proving easy. She would have learnt from Fisher's mistake, and he could hear Eddie Makepeace advising her to remain calm at all times and not to let him goad her. However hard he tried, he couldn't come up with a ploy to break through her defence. The waste paper basket was full, and the A4 pad in front of him was blank. How could he demonstrate to the jury that Emma's mother had been right when she compared Virginia to her Siamese cat, Cleopatra? They are both beautiful, well-groomed, vain, cunning, manipulative predators who assume that everyone else was put on earth to serve them. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and he was going over some old Barrington's boardroom minutes when he came up with a new line of questioning. Major Fisher had driven out of the Commons car park soon after the House had risen on Friday afternoon. One or two colleagues had wished him luck, but they didn't sound convincing. As he drove down to the West Country, he thought about the letter he would have to write if his local executive committee didn't support him. He remained in his flat all the next day, not turning the front page of the morning papers, not bothering with breakfast or lunch as the lonely hours ticked by. Long before the sun was over the yardarm, he began opening bottles and draining them. During the evening, he sat by the phone and waited impatiently to hear how the committee had voted on the no-confidence motion. He returned to the kitchen, opened a tin of pilchards, but left them on the table, untouched. He sat down in the drawing room to watch an episode of Dad's Army, but didn't laugh. Finally, he picked up a copy of Friday's Bristol Evening Post and looked again at the front page headline. Local Conservatives to Decide Fate of MP, See Leader, page 11. He turned to page 11. He and the editor had always been on good terms, so he had rather hoped. But he didn't get beyond the headline. Do the honourable thing, Major. He tossed the paper aside and didn't turn on the light as the sun disappeared behind the highest building. The phone rang at 10:12. He grabbed the receiver and immediately recognised the voice of the local party chairman.
Good evening, Peter.
Good evening, Major. I won't beat about the bush. I'm sorry to say that the committee didn't support you.
Was it close?
I'm afraid not, said Maynard. It was unanimous. So it might be wise for you to write a letter offering your resignation,
rather than waiting for the executive committee to formally deselect you. So much more civilized that way, don't you think? I am sorry, Alex. No sooner had he put the phone down than it rang again. It was a reporter from the Post, asking him if he wanted to comment on the unanimous decision to call for his resignation. He didn't even bother to say no comment before slamming the phone back down. In an alcoholic blur, he walked unsteadily through to his study, sat down and placed his head in his hands while he thought about the wording of the letter. He took a sheet of House of Commons paper from the letter rack and began to write. When he'd finished, he waited for the ink to dry before he folded it, sealed it in an envelope, and placed it on his desk. He leant down and opened the bottom drawer of his desk, took out his service revolver, put the muzzle in his mouth, and pulled the trigger. Chapter 43. The courtroom was packed, the two combatants ready. All that was needed was for the bell to ring so the first punch could be landed. On one side of the ring sat Mr. Trelford, who was going over the order of his questions for the last time. Giles, Emma, and Seb sat behind him, talking quietly, making sure they didn't disturb him. Giles looked up as a police constable entered the courtroom, walked across to counsel's bench, and handed Mr. Trelford an envelope. The word urgent was written below his name. Trelford opened it, extracted a letter, and read it slowly. Giles learnt nothing from the expression on the barrister's face, but he recognised the familiar green portcullis crest at the head of the paper. Sir Edward sat alone with his client on the other side of the ring, delivering his final instructions.
"Be calm. Take your time before answering each question," he whispered. "You're not in a hurry. Face the jury and never forget that you are the only people in the room who matter."
The crowd fell silent, and everyone rose when the bell rang for the first round and the referee entered the ring. If Mrs. Justice Lane was surprised to find the press and public galleries of her courtroom packed on a Monday morning, she didn't show it. She bowed, and everyone in the well of the court returned the compliment. Once they'd all settled back into their seats, with only Sir Edward still standing, she invited the eminent Silk to call his first witness. Virginia walked slowly up to the witness box, and when she took the oath, she could barely be heard. She wore a black tailored suit that emphasized her slim figure, a black pillbox hat, no jewelry, and little makeup, clearly wanting to remind all those present of Major Fisher's untimely death. Had the jury retired there and then to deliver their verdict, the result would have been unanimous, and Sir Edward would happily have settled for that.
"For the record, would you tell the court your name and where you live?"
asked Sir Edward as he adjusted his wig.
"Virginia Fenwick. I live alone in a modest flat in Cadogan Gardens, SW3.
Giles smiled. "My name is Lady Virginia Alice Sarah Lucinda Fenwick, only daughter of the 9th Earl of Fenwick, and I have homes in Scotland and Tuscany, and a large apartment on 3 floors in Knightsbridge, with a butler, maid, and chauffeur," would have been more accurate.
"Can I confirm that you were formerly married to Sir Giles Barrington, from whom you are now divorced?"
"Sadly, yes,"
said Virginia, turning towards the jury.
"Giles was the love of my life, but his family never considered me good enough for him."
Giles would have happily throttled the woman, while Emma wanted to jump up and protest. Mr. Trelford crossed out 4 of his well-prepared questions.
"But despite that, and all you've been put through, you still don't bear a grudge against Mrs. Clifton?"
"No, I do not. In truth, it was with a heavy heart that I finally issued this writ, because Mrs. Clifton has many admirable qualities, and has unquestionably been an outstanding chairman of a public company, making her a role model for aspiring professional women."
Mr. Trelford began to write out some new questions.
Then why did you issue the writ?
Because she accused me of willfully attempting to destroy her family company. Nothing could be further from the truth. I simply wanted to know on behalf of ordinary shareholders, like myself, if one of her directors had disposed of all his stock the weekend before the AGM, because in my opinion that would have greatly harmed the company. But rather than answer my question, she chose to belittle me, giving everyone in that crowded hall the impression that I didn't know what I was talking about.
"Word perfect," said Giles under his breath, which caused Mr. Trelford to smile. He turned and whispered,
"I agree. But then while Sir Edward is on his feet, she knows what questions to expect. She'll have no crib sheet to rely on when I cross-examine her."
"In particular," continued Sir Edward, "you are referring to Mrs. Clifton's reply to the quite valid question you raised at the AGM."
"Yes. Rather than answer that question, she decided to humiliate me and ruin my reputation in front of a packed audience, many of them my friends. I was left with no alternative but to seek the recourse of the law."
"And you were referring on that occasion not to Major Fisher, as Mrs. Clifton erroneously suggested, but to Mr. Cedric Hardcastle, who, as you pointed out, sold his entire stock over the weekend before the AGM, thus placing the company in jeopardy."
"That is correct, Sir Edward."
"Did she really just flutter her eyelids?" whispered Giles.
"And the late Major Fisher was one of your financial advisers?"
"Yes. And whenever he recommended I should buy or sell shares, I followed his advice. I always found him honest, trustworthy, and utterly professional."
Emma couldn't bring herself to look at the jury. Giles did, to find they were hanging on Virginia's every word. Sir Edward lowered his voice, like a great thespian demanding silence before he delivered his closing line.
"Let me finally ask you, Lady Virginia, if you have any regrets about issuing this libel writ against Mrs. Clifton?"
"Yes, I do, Sir Edward. The tragic and unnecessary death of my dear friend, Major Alex Fisher, makes the outcome of this trial unimportant. If by withdrawing this action I could have saved his life, I would have done so without hesitation."
She turned to the jury, took a handkerchief from her sleeve, and dabbed away an imaginary tear.
"I'm sorry you have been put through this ordeal, Lady Virginia, so soon after the death of your friend and adviser, Major Fisher. No more questions, my lady."
If they had been alone together in chambers, Trelford would have congratulated his learned friend on a quite masterful cross-examination. He opened his file to see the words Giles had advised, written at the top of the first page: "Make her lose her temper." He then looked down at his first question, newly minted.
"Lady Virginia,"
he said, emphasizing the word lady,
"you told the court of your admiration for Mrs. Clifton and your devotion to her brother Sir Giles Barrington, but despite that, you didn't invite a single member of the Barrington or Clifton families to attend your wedding to Sir Giles."
"That was a shared decision, Mr. Trelford. Giles felt every bit as strongly about it as I did."
"If that is the case, Lady Virginia, perhaps you could explain your father's words at the time of the wedding, recorded in the Daily Express by William Hickey. My daughter was ready to call off the whole thing if Giles hadn't agreed to her demands."
"Gossip column tittle-tattle, written to sell newspapers, Mr. Trelford. Frankly, I'm surprised you feel the need to resort to such tactics."
Sir Edward couldn't resist a smile. His client had clearly seen that one coming.
"And later, in your evidence," said Trelford, moving swiftly on, "you went on to blame Mrs. Clifton for your divorce.
She can be a very determined woman, said Virginia, as I'm sure you yourself have discovered.
But surely your divorce had nothing to do with Mrs. Clifton, but was rather caused by the quarrels you had with your husband about him being cut out of his mother's will.
That is not true, Mr. Trelford. Charles's inheritance never interested me. I married him for richer, for poorer, and frankly, since you mention it, I was richer than he was.
This caused enough laughter in court for the judge to scowl menacingly down from her bench.
So it wasn't you who insisted that Sir Giles should issue a writ against his own sister, disputing the validity of his mother's will. That was another shared decision?
No, that was Giles's decision. I think I advised against it at the time.
Perhaps you'd like to reconsider that answer, Lady Virginia, as I can always call Sir Giles as a witness and ask him to set the record straight.
Well, I admit that I felt Giles had been treated rather shabbily by his family, and that he had the right at least to question the validity of his mother's will, as it had been rewritten while the poor lady was in hospital, only days before she died.
And what was the court's decision on that occasion?
The judge came down in favour of Mrs. Clifton.
No, Lady Virginia, he did not. I have Mr. Justice Cameron's judgment to hand. He ruled that the will was valid, and that Mrs. Clifton's mother was of sound mind when she executed it, which is particularly relevant, considering what she had to say about you at the time.
Sir Edward was quickly on his feet.
Mr. Trelford, said the judge sharply, before Sir Edward could offer an opinion, we have already travelled down that road, and it came to a dead end. Do I make myself clear?
I apologise, my lady. Would you have any objection to my asking Lady Virginia if I could read out?
Yes, I would, Mr. Trelford. Move on, she said sharply.
Trelford glanced across at the jury. As it was clear from the looks on their faces, they had ignored the judge's instruction not to read any newspaper reports of the case, and must have been well aware of what Mrs. Clifton's mother thought of Lady Virginia, he was happy to oblige the judge's wishes and to move on.
Lady Virginia, are you aware that despite the learned judge's ruling in favour of Mrs. Clifton and her sister, Dr. Grace Barrington, they both agreed that their brother could go on living at their family home in Gloucestershire, as well as at the London house in Smith Square, while Mrs. Clifton and her husband continue to reside at their more modest manor house.
I have no idea what Giles's domestic arrangements were after I divorced him for adultery, let alone what Mrs. Clifton was up to.
You had no idea what Mrs. Clifton was up to,
repeated Mr. Trelford.
In which case, Lady Virginia, you must have either a very short or a very selective memory, because only a few moments ago you told the jury how much you admired Mrs. Clifton. Allow me to remind you of your exact words.
He slowly turned back a page of his file.
Emma has many admirable qualities, and has unquestionably been an outstanding chairman of a public company, making her a role model for aspiring professional women. That wasn't always your opinion, was it, Lady Virginia?
My opinion of Mrs. Clifton has not changed, and I stand by what I said.
Did you purchase 7.5% of Barrington stock?
Major Fisher did, on my behalf.
For what purpose?
As a long-term investment.
And not because you wanted to take a seat on the board of the company?
No.
Major Fisher, as you well know, represented my interests on the board.
Not in 1958 he didn't,
because in that year you turned up at an extraordinary general meeting of Barrington's in Bristol, claiming your right to sit on the board and to vote on who should be the company's next chairman. For the record, Lady Virginia, who did you vote for?
I voted for Major Fisher. Or do you mean you voted against Mrs. Clifton?
Certainly not.
I listened to both their presentations most carefully and decided on balance in favour of Major Fisher rather than Mrs. Clifton. Well, then, clearly you have forgotten what you said on that occasion. But as it was recorded in the minutes of the meeting, allow me to remind you. I don't believe that women were put on earth to chair boards, take on trade union leaders, build luxury liners, or have to raise vast sums of money from bankers in the City of London. Hardly a ringing endorsement for aspiring professional women. Perhaps you should read on, Mr. Trelford, and not be quite so selective in your quotations.
Trelford looked beyond the paragraph he'd underlined and hesitated. Mrs. Justice Lane gave him a nudge.
I would like to hear what else Lady Virginia had to say on that occasion.
And so would I, said Sir Edward,
loud enough for everyone in court to hear. Trelford reluctantly read out the next couple of lines.
I shall be supporting Major Fisher, and I only hope that Mrs. Clifton will accept the Major's generous offer to serve as his deputy.
Mr. Trelford looked up.
Please keep going, Mr. Trelford,
prompted Lady Virginia.
I came here with an open mind, willing to give her the benefit of the doubt. But sadly, she has not lived up to my expectations.
I think you'll find, Mr. Trelford, said Virginia, that it's you who has either a very short or a very selective memory, not me.
Sir Edward applauded, although his hands didn't actually touch. Mr. Trelford quickly changed the subject.
Shall we move on to Mrs. Clifton's words, which you claim were libelous and belittled you?
I'm quite happy to do so.
If it was your intention to bring the company down, Lady Virginia, continued Trelford as if he hadn't been interrupted, then you have failed, and failed lamentably, because you were defeated by decent, ordinary people who want this company to be a success. Now, Major Fisher admitted that he carried out his dealings in Barrington shares simply to make money, which in his case was illegal.
In his case, but not in mine, said Lady Virginia. In my case, he was simply acting on my behalf. For all I know, he was giving exactly the same advice to several other clients.
So Major Fisher was not a close friend who kept you in touch with what was happening on the board of Barrington's, but simply a professional advisor.
Even if we were friends, Mr. Trelford, when it came to business matters, everything he did on my behalf was conducted at arm's length.
I would suggest, Lady Virginia, that when it came to business matters, far from being conducted at arm's length, it was very much hands-on. And just as Mrs. Clifton suggested, the two of you planned on three separate occasions to try to bring the company down.
Mr. Trelford, I think you are confusing me with Mr. Cedric Hardcastle, a director of the company, who sold all his stock over the weekend before the AGM. When I asked Mrs. Clifton a perfectly legitimate question about who that director was, she seemed to have conveniently forgotten his name. Someone else with either a very short or a very selective memory.
Sir Edward's smile was growing broader by the minute, while Trelford was sounding less and less assured. He quickly turned another page.
We all regret the tragic death of Major Fisher.
I certainly do, said Virginia. And as I said earlier, which I'm confident you will have recorded word for word, Mr. Trelford, I would never have considered issuing a writ in the first place if I had thought even for a moment that it could have resulted in the tragic and unnecessary death of my dear friend.
I do indeed remember your words, Lady Virginia, but I wondered if you noticed that just before proceedings opened this morning, a policeman entered this court and handed me a letter.
Sir Edward edged forward in his seat, ready to pounce.
Would it surprise you to know that it was addressed to me, and that it was from your dear friend, Major Fisher?
If Mr. Trelford had wanted to go on speaking, his words would have been drowned out by a cacophony of noise that came from all corners of the courtroom. Only the judge and the jury remained impassive. He waited for complete silence before he continued.
Lady Virginia, would you like me to read out to the court the last words your dear friend Major Fisher wrote moments before he died?
Sir Edward leapt up.
My lady, I have not seen this letter in the bundle of evidence, and therefore have no idea if it's admissible or even authentic.
The bloodstain on the envelope would suggest its authenticity, my lady, said Trelford, waving the envelope in front of the jury. I haven't seen the letter either, Sir Edward, said the judge, so it certainly isn't admissible as evidence until I say so.
Trelford was quite happy for them to go on discussing the legal niceties as to whether the letter was admissible or not, well aware that he had made his point without having to produce any evidence. Giles studied the sphinx-like expression on Trelford's face and couldn't be sure if Emma's counsel even wanted the letter to be read out in court. But following what had started out as a triumphant morning for Lady Virginia, he had once again sown a seed of doubt in the jury's minds. Everyone in the court's eyes were on him. Mr. Trelford tucked the envelope back into an inside pocket of his jacket. He smiled up at the judge and said,
"No more questions, my lady."
Chapter 44. When the cell door swung open on Tuesday morning, two guards marched in to find Harry and Babakov sitting on the floor in opposite corners of the cell, not speaking. They grabbed Babakov, and as they dragged him out of the cell, Harry bowed his head, as if he wanted nothing to do with the man. A moment later, two more guards appeared, walking at a more leisurely pace. Although they took Harry firmly by the arms, they didn't jostle, push, or drag him out of the cell, which made him wonder if it was just possible that Babakov's plan had worked. However, the guards didn't let go of Harry as they led him up the stairs, along the corridor and into the courtroom, as if they feared he might try to make a run for it. But where would he run, and just how far did they imagine he would get? Harry had insisted that Babakov sleep on the one thin mattress in their cramped cell, but the Russian had refused, explaining that he couldn't afford to get used to such a luxury when he would be returning to a stone floor in Siberia on Tuesday night. Sleeping on the straw that was liberally scattered over the floor was quite enough luxury for one weekend. The truth was, neither of them had slept for any length of time, which brought back memories for Harry of his days behind enemy lines. By the time the guards came to collect them on the Tuesday morning, they were both mentally and physically exhausted, having used every available hour for the challenge they had set themselves. When the two guards accompanied Harry into the court, he was surprised to find the chief prosecutor and the jury already in their places. He hardly had time to catch his breath before the door at the back of the room opened and the three judges entered and returned to their seats on the raised dais. Once again, the tribunal chairman didn't even glance in Harry's direction, but immediately turned to the jury. She opened a file in front of her and began what Harry assumed was her summing up. She only spoke for a few minutes, rarely raising her head from the text. Harry could only wonder who had written it and when.
"Comrades, you have heard all the evidence and have had more than enough time to consider your verdict. Can there be any doubt that the prisoner is guilty of the crimes he has been charged with, and that he deserves to be sentenced to a long term of imprisonment? The jury will be interested to learn that this will not be the prisoner's first experience of jail. He has already served a sentence for murder in the United States. But do not let that influence you, because it is you and you alone who must decide if he is guilty."
Harry had to admire the fact that the two other judges were able to keep a straight face while she continued to read out the prepared statement.
"Comrades, first let me ask